Hello and welcome to The Preservationist, the monthly radio show for fans of local historic architecture, the history of unique buildings, and the people from our community working to preserve and restore them. I'm Astronomist Rayet, the president of the board of directors at Lower Columbia Preservation Society and the host of The Preservationist. This month, we are chatting with Abigail Mack, the owner of the historic Dupay Building in downtown Owaka, Washington, located on 102 First Avenue, the intersection of First and Spruce. The Dupay Building has a very rich history in the community and is one of the beautiful historic buildings in Owaka. Abigail, thank you so much for joining me today. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about yourself? Are you originally from Owaka or in this area?
No, actually, and thanks for having me. I grew up in Fort Collins, Colorado, in a historic neighborhood in a historic house, and kind of developed a love for historic housing from both of my parents. So we spent a lot of time working on houses. After college, moved to Columbus, Ohio, where I became an affordable housing developer for a community development organization, and also did my master's in city planning at the same time there, and really got to go in depth doing both historic preservation and then city planning and housing development.
Nice. And just to give the listeners some context about the history of the Dupay Building, you know, this was a building that was completed in 1896, and it has so many unique features architectural-wise. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of the Dupay Building itself?
Yeah, so the building was completed in 1896, as you said. Originally, there was actually the Markham House sat on that site, and they moved it to put the building there. And it was built by B.A. Seaborg, who lots of folks would know. And I guess some of the coolest parts of it are that it was a hardware store. It was kind of a company store for the Aberdeen Packing Company originally. And unique features that everybody loves are that I don't think it was original, but it has, you know, within a few years, they added the mezzanine level of the commercial space. And so that's still intact. And it's hung on these really cool steel rods that hang over the floor joists above and suspend it so it doesn't have supports below. So it's like a floating mezzanine. It's pretty unique. It also has cast iron pillars and columns that were made in the Astoria Foundry that are just beautiful. And then things that people maybe don't know as far as production goes, but all the ornamental caps. And a lot of it is also cast iron, but then like the columns are capped with these unique floral designs, and those are actually hammered copper.
Yeah, no, that's super unique because you don't see that nowadays.
No. You know, it was built originally for the Aberdeen Packing Company, and then it transferred hands a couple of times pretty quickly. And then eventually it was purchased by the Dupay family, and it stayed in that family for a really long time. And they're kind of an anchor in the community, which is why it's considered the Dupay Building, even though it wasn't originally named that. You know, you can walk down the street and probably meet a dozen people who had Joe Dupay as their, you know, as their teacher at Owaka High School, or who can sit there and tell you memories of going there as a child. And slowly, even within the family, the business enterprise expanded. And so what you see now is the Dupay Building, which is, you know, currently a deep green with cream columns. It's also got this 1920s building next to it, which is like a California style with the Spanish roof. And that was built later, but then they connected them. So there's three doorways that connect that building. That was also later expanded. You know, it looks like 1937 was the last expansion of that section. And the building's use changed slightly, and it became more of a department store. And they put the hardware store next door. And then even after that, the Dupay family was, you know, Owaka was booming, and they built what is currently the Owaka Cidery and Spawn Fly Fishing across the street in the 1950s buildings.
So now, with the Dupay Building, you guys have been going under several restoration preservation projects. Now, when you originally purchased this building, what was the state and condition it was in? Was it seemingly okay?
Or it looked structurally pretty sound. As far as the brickwork goes, it's great. That part's amazing. The foundation was in perfect shape. If you walk across the floors today, they're all the original fir floors, and in great condition. There's almost no movement on the building, but because it had been neglected for so long and vacant for so long, There was a lot of water penetration. There was about 5 layers of roof up there, and it had just leaked all the way through. So in some of the building, water was coming through the roof all the way through to the first floor. And especially in the smaller building that's attached, which it's all one site, it's all one property now because of the connection. So the little building that is to the south, you know, there's a lot of second floor terminating chimneys that would heat the upstairs, the residential units. So each unit had its own chimney, and you can see those columns on the roof. And some of those chimneys were just falling through the floor. It was so bad. The first thing I did was get a new roof put on the entire building, and that's when we found out that there was some structural repair needed on the roof trusses on the back, and that the way it was built was, you know, it's got these 18-inch solid brick walls that then have a metal L-bracket on top, and then they would put the joists on top of those L-brackets, and then they would put a tie rod through the building and hook in the joists so that it would be snug. So that those tie rods were actually what was supporting the roof structure.
What was the process like for you beginning this restoration project? Because obviously it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of meetings and coordinating with people that can work on this type of stuff. What was that process like for you?
I mean, that's kind of second nature to me because I was a developer for so long. So that part wasn't hard. It's mostly just understanding that with old structures, you know, you can run all the performers you want. You can have all the estimates you want, and you never know what you're getting until you open it up. And that combined with the fact that it was the beginning of the pandemic made it just astronomically difficult to really be able to predict. You know, people ask me for timelines and I can't give them one anymore, because when I purchased it in 2018, things were pretty predictable. I thought I knew prices. I thought I knew contractors. And then everything, you know, the world changed. So it's not a streamlined development the way that I would be accustomed to doing it, because you have to figure everything out. And development's very different in Owako because it's such a small community. So if you need a building inspector, we're borrowing the building inspector from Long Beach because our departments are not that big. If you need electricity, it's not what I'm accustomed to in a bigger city where it's one, you know, entity controls everything, and, you know, there's a department of development. You have to go to the PUD, which then coordinates with the city and the Department of Transportation. So it's pretty complicated, actually, to just even making small steps.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other things that were challenging to overcome or begin with?
There's a lot, but I mean, honestly, it's about a 16,000 square foot building, and I've had to break it into phases in order to be able to manage and also afford, you know, bootstrapping it, because you can't get financing on a vacant building, especially as an individual and not a giant developer. Try to emphasize a lot that, you know, a giant developer probably wouldn't take on this project. That's why it sat there for so long and was neglected, because it's a big risk. Some of the challenges are figuring out how to break it up into the right size where, you know, I can figure out, okay, what systems do I need in place? What contractors can do the framing for this? Who can, you know, how do I get electricity to this part of the building? How do I wrap that envelope so that it's, you know, safety-wise that it has a 2-hour fire rating between units, things like that. And then on top of it, trying to honor the heritage and the history of the building and keep it as close to historic as possible. But, you know, it's not protected, so it's not on the National Register. It's not under any programs. But I still want to make sure that I'm doing things as appropriate as I can.
You know, with that being said, just to give our listeners some perspective and visual on what's actually been done, you know, you guys replaced the roof, you did some painting, and you're also doing a little bit of window repair too?
I guess I could take a step back. The first thing I had to do was gut everything. So we basically gutted everything down to stud. I hauled away like almost 15 dumpsters worth of material. I mean, it was sad to take a lot of it down, but in order to, you know, the building is in such shape that we have to redo every single mechanical. So all new wiring, all new plumbing, all new fixtures, all new lights, new roof. I'm going to have to, unfortunately, fur out the walls to meet energy code. So I'm going to have to change a little bit of the integrity of the interior. And then there was a lot of stucco repair that had to be done because it's the Pacific Northwest and it faces south. And it was just a sponge. let's see what else. You know, I had to gut the building and then do the roof and then do structural repair, which ended up being an emergency to prevent the back of the building from collapsing once we realized what was happening. Part of what we did was replace what was for some reason the only framed wall on the entire site, is the very rear of it. And it had T111, which is just, you know, tacky rotting wood. And so I did have to find a stucco professional to come in and put stucco up on that wall so that it matched the entire exterior, because it didn't used to. And we're not sure why that wall is that way, whether it failed at some point and then they reframed it, or if they built it that way, or if it was a delivery bay. I haven't been able, the museum contractors, nobody's been able to figure it out. And the age of that back wall, there's a lot of signatures on it that indicate what year it was built. So it was, you know, probably in the 1910s, 1920s. Anyway, so yeah, we've done stucco repair on the bigger building. We've done lots of repair to the any of the ornamental features that we could. And then we were lucky enough to get a grant from the Washington Trust for Historic Preservation, partnering with the Iwako Museum on that, and remove and repair and then reinstall every one of those arched windows with the leaded glass, because while structurally they were amazing and had, you know, have lasted 120 years, each of those little Coke bottle lenses, they were, you know, would wave in the wind. It sounds like Tinkerbell in there. So we're down to just having the last four to do. But one of the challenges with that is that in order to meet current building code, I either have to put it on the historic registers so that there's an exemption for fenestration, or I have to put storm windows over those in order to meet code. Mm-hmm. So it's always a difficult balance to figure out what the right thing is to do.
Yeah.
I think it'd be a shame to put storm windows up, but we'll see which one we choose.
Yeah. And, you know, with those repairs and the restoration process, has there been any shocking discoveries that you made? Like anything interesting that you found in the building?
I don't think there's anything shocking per se. You know, there was layers upon layers of history. So as we were gutting, I was trying to document, you know, once we took off something, you might find five layers of wallpaper on a wall. So I would, you know, I gave those to the local museum. There's a couple places where we found like some toys or a soapbox or like a little tiny pillbox from the 1800s stuffed in the wall. But for the most part, there wasn't many surprises. It's more just pleasant, you know, discoveries. And I found the signature of the architect's wife on the wall in the plaster. And there's some signatures from the very original owners and the second owners that are in what used to be, we think, it's where most people remember there being a British pub most recently, but it was originally a storeroom. And so there's some signatures on the walls in there, but no really shocking discoveries.
Mm-hmm. And those are all fun discoveries that you're talking about, which is nice.
Yeah,
those
I guess, I mean, the worst thing that's happened lately that was shocking and unhappy was that at some point, since I purchased the building, there's been a lot of water that's gone under it. So my foundation is currently jeopardized. My engineer seems to think that it's because the water mains in Iwako, some of which are, you know, the original mains, were very old. It broke right at that intersection where the light is. And so there's some real challenges now on how to address that, fix that so that it doesn't become an issue.
You always have your ups and downs with these projects, but for you personally, what has been the most rewarding part doing this project and taking it on? Because you've been doing a lot of different things. You know, I personally, you know, I grew up in Astoria and I've seen that building every time I go over to Iwako or Long Beach. And over these past few years, I've been seeing the transformation of it. It's beautiful. I love seeing like that it has a mural up. I love seeing it painted, the window stuff. And, you know, it really interested me because these are things that I grew up with seeing all the time. And I remember what it did look like, you know, pre, you know, 2018 and the condition it was in. And it's just amazing to see how beautiful it's becoming and coming together. So is there anything that you would say is the most rewarding part for you for this project?
I mean, the most rewarding part is just knowing, even, you know, if I quit today, that the building is going to stand another 100 years because it's got a new roof on it, right? And it's not going to continue to deteriorate. The support from our community is amazing. People are so excited about it. I wish that people's excitement could be articulated into funding for the project, because that's the biggest challenge, is self-funding it. But, you know, just a month ago, we were able to open the first commercial space in the building that's been open in the last, like, 30 years. So Ship Records and More, which was located across from the museum, relocated into the smaller commercial space that we were able to get our, you know, certificate of occupancy on there. So that's really exciting to have anything open in it. And then additionally, I finished an apartment above that. So it's nice to call it my home.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just like looking at the building itself, can you explain a little bit about the plans? Because, you know, I know that there's some information on the website about what you guys hope to do with it. What does the future look like for the DuPage building?
Right. So right now we have Ship Records and More downstairs in the smaller space. And there'll be a bar in there, actually, once the licensing goes through. And then there's my apartment above. But then next door in the larger building, which most people consider the DuPage, upstairs there'll be seven lofts. Or seven apartments available. There's a chance that I would do short-term rental with that temporarily, because basically the expense of the building is more than twice what I thought it would be so far. And if I need to pay bills, I have to pay bills. But my goal and my dream would be that it's a place for people to live. And because, as you probably know, even here and everywhere in our area, there's such a housing crisis. And I think that the right answer is that, you know, people in our community could live there. So that's the goal, is that upstairs, the whole second floor where all the arched windows, that will be apartments. And then I did work with the city of Iwako when I initially bought the building to be able to convert the back half into residential lofts as well. I might still do that. I might not. I think that it's a great use for it. But now that there's some more commercial development happening in Iwako, I think there's opportunities to use the parking lot in a more creative way and complement the commercial side of Spruce Street, where the Iwako Cidery is, and see if we can have some connectivity, because, you know, millions of cars drive through that light each year to go to Cape Disappointment, and our community's not, you know, getting the economic benefit of that.
We'll return back to Abigail Mack's interview in just a moment. But first, I would like to take a moment to invite you to this month's Topics in Preservation. Topics in Preservation is a monthly discussion and conversation held by the Lower Columbia Preservation Society at the LCPS office on 389 12th Street in downtown Astoria. Topics in Preservation is free and open to the public, so if anybody is interested, definitely come and check it out. For more information about this month's Topics in Preservation, please visit www.lcpsociety.org/events. This month's Topics in Preservation will be held on October 16th at 6 p.m. We hope to see you there. And to connect with Lower Columbia Preservation Society, be sure to visit our website, or you can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Be sure to follow us to find more information about our Topics in Preservation and other events such as LCPS Presents, which happens every second Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the Pacific Distillery on 55 4th Street in Astoria, Org. Now returning back to our interview with Abigail. One thing about the DuPage building is you guys have a really great location. You can't miss the building when you drive by.
It really is, I'd say, shy of, like, you know, some of the buildings in Oysterville and maybe like the Shelburne Pub. There's really very few buildings on the peninsula there's no other building of that caliber, because it was just done so spectacularly in the first place. And then so many other buildings have disappeared, right? There's a gravel lot across the street, right? There's almost no historic buildings left that are large and commercial.
Yeah, and that's what makes the DuPage building very unique, is it has that very beautiful character of architecture. Do you have a favorite architectural detail of the building or your favorite part of the building specifically?
I'm not sure that I have a favorite. It's just got such a grand scale to it. You don't realize when you're looking at a photograph of it until you're in it, just how high the ceilings are. 18-foot ceilings on the first floor and, you know, 12 or 14 on the second floor. And just those windows when you're in one of those apartments are, it's grand. They're 10 feet tall. And they're only about 6 inches off the ground. So they just are an entire wall of windows. It's just great. And something really cool about when they designed that is that any of the rooms upstairs that don't have those beautiful windows that are facing inward all have these really great skylights. And so I did also replace all the skylights so that you have natural light in every room. And honestly, we don't even have electricity right now, and you don't need it in the daytime.
So, yeah.
And in the smaller building, in the gray building, where my apartment is, there's actually a 5x8 original skylight. It's huge.
And then in terms of, you know, advice to building owners, you know, people that maybe have a historic building, and they know there's repairs needed to be made. You obviously, you know, you have a little bit of experience with this now. Do you have any advice for people that are interested or wanting to do these preservation projects, but they just don't know about it? What would you say to them?
Well, my former boss used to always tell me that nothing works in an old house but its owner. So there's that.
I love that.
Which is just take it with a grain of salt and know that, you know, it's always going to be a bigger challenge but a bigger reward than you thought it would be. I know that you guys offer some workshops and that the local community college has some really great opportunities to learn the skills to really do a true historic preservation. I think those are great classes to have just to learn to reglaze a window or how to, you know, set the weights in it if that's what you want. But I think the most important thing is, like, start small if you're going to do it yourself. And then also I always just focus on what do I need to do to preserve the building first and then, you know, take small steps after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, you have this passion for, you know, saving this Dupay building and making it beautiful and, you know, preserving it. What does preservation mean to you and why is it important to you?
It's one of those things that you're just, you know, like you said, you grew up here and you, in a historic town and you get and you develop an interest in it. And for me, it was growing up working with my dad and appreciating the detail and the design work and the craftsmanship of all of these structures. And then later on in grad school, appreciating how the history of our communities can be seen through the architecture. And, you know, it's not just the architecture, but it's the people. So it's the Dupays. It's the folks who grew up in that community that can walk in and tell me stories. So that's part of it. It's not just the physical and the beauty of it, which I love, and but it's the history of the community that goes along with the buildings.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, is there anything else that you would like to share about this project or anything upcoming? Anything else you'd like to tell our listeners that maybe you wish more people knew?
I think that you know, just understanding when people ask me what the timeline is or what the plan is, it's so difficult on a project of this scale. And in a community where, you know, we have limited infrastructure money, we have limited infrastructure. So the biggest challenge right now for my building is that there's not electricity. And in order to get electricity, it ranges from $50,000 to $150,000 just to get a line across the 101 for three phase. And that doesn't include any wiring or any meters or anything in the actual building. So I think that's important for people to understand, making sure that water lines are sufficient to for future use is another challenge. But really just understanding that it all adds up. So, you know, when people want to know what's taking so long, I'm always like, well, you know, that front door was $5,000 and I had to earn that. And, you know, we painted it ourselves. We did a lot of the stucco restoration ourselves, and I do all the demolition and we do a lot of the finish work, anything, you know, but I hire out contractors for all the major trades, but it's a lot of work for one person.
Yeah. It's a ton of work, and especially, you know, finding the people to do it. Even if you're doing it yourself, it's just like, that's still your time and your efforts. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was so grateful to be able to find, you know, Jim Hannon, who's a specialist in those windows, but trying to find somebody who could do stucco at a price that I could afford was almost impossible. So we ended up doing it ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the, I would really love to be able to go back later on in the future and do more appropriate restoration to some of the architectural features and the details of the cast iron. And then also there's an entire section that's missing if you look back at the historic pictures. And you can get those, you know, redone in foam these days. But until I have some working capital from the actual project, like, I have to put those dreams aside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's always something to consider. So, Abigail, my next question is how can people reach out to you and get updates on this project? Do you guys have a website, any social media pages where us as an audience can follow the progress of the DuPay building and its beautiful restoration efforts?
Yeah, we are on the DuPay buildings on Instagram and Facebook, which is probably where I put the most updates. I'm not very good at updating the website, unfortunately. We do have a website, which is thedupay.com. And the best way to support the project is really, go down to Owako and support our local businesses and our economy. And then we have t-shirts, hats, hoodies for sale, both at the record store and at the museum around the corner. Any profits from that just go straight into the building. And it's also available on Airbnb, the apartment upstairs. So if people want to, you know, stay in the first apartment that's available, it's available now. And then moving forward, we really will be looking for assistance. There'll probably be a GoFundMe for the electric and for the water, because those are things that stay with the building. And it's very difficult to fund.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Abigail, for joining me and, you know, chatting with me today about the DuPay building and sharing about this project. It's a lot of hard work, and our community thanks you for this, because it's super big to take on. And it's so wonderful for me personally seeing those changes, and it makes me excited about it. So thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of The Preservationists. We hope you tune in again next month. The Preservationist airs every third Tuesday of the month at 9:30 a.m. on KMUN. I'd like to give a special thanks to my guest for this month, Abigail Mack, for sharing with our listeners about the DuPay building in Ilwaco, Washington. I also like to give a thanks to the team here at KMUN, the staff, volunteers, and members of the Lower Columbia Preservation Society, and thank you to Camila Swerdloff for producing our theme song for The Preservationists. And thank you for listening to The Preservationists, and remember, anyone can be a preservationist. The Preservationists is a production of the Lower Columbia Preservation Society for KMUN, written and produced by Astronomist Ray. Until next time, I'm Astronomist Ray. Thank you for tuning in.